Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews podcast. I'm Dave Baxter. I'm the funds editor on the Investors Chronicle. And today I'm joined by Joe Baumfreund, investment manager on the AVI Global Investment Trust. AVI Global is a £1 billion vehicle with a global remit and a focus on investments in listed companies whose shares stand at a discount to the estimated value of their underlying assets. That in practice translates into a mixture of different holdings from Japanese companies to investment trusts and holding companies. This contrarian approach has seen the fund perform well versus its rivals, though like many of its peers, it does have to contend with a runaway MSCI World Index. So Joe, thanks very much for coming on. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So very briefly, because the trust is a bit different, I think, to many of its peers, it might be good just to explain how it works and what your kind of process is.
Well, as you said, we're a global investment trust, which means our universe in theory is any global equity out there. But in practice, our philosophy is based around the idea that stock markets are not always efficient. And in particular, there are areas of the stock market that are neglected and overlooked by other investors. And those are the areas that really that excite us. They're neglected and overlooked for a variety of different reasons. It could be illiquidity, it could be complexity, it could be lack of research, it could even be laziness. But that's where we find the greatest inefficiencies. And we're really about building a relatively concentrated portfolio, a portfolio that looks very different from a broad benchmark or a broad market index, and focusing on a select group of companies that we think have attractive qualities in that they give us exposure to good quality businesses, trading at discounts to their intrinsic value or asset value. And on top of that, where we think something is likely to happen in order to crystallize that undervaluation and reverse that discount, or if it's not going to happen in and of itself, where we can be a driving force of unlocking that value.
Mm. And how, maybe let's jump into that actually, because I don't know if you describe it as activist, but that kind of tendency is interesting. And you are seeing that in particular in areas like Japan. What does that actually entail?
So activism takes different forms. And for us as well, there isn't one way of doing it. It depends really upon the situation. For us, the starting point, I would say, is that we always prefer and believe that the best outcomes can be achieved privately. So you don't have to go public, you don't have to be a bully, you don't have to have your name up in lights in order to achieve success. And very often, companies, directors, boards respond better to that private engagement rather than the public bullying type of engagement. So for us, the starting point is we own good quality businesses that we think are going to grow in value over time. So we don't have the clock ticking against us. But nonetheless, if we are in a position to affect some change, we like to do so. So when we invest in Japanese small cap companies with a 5 to 10% shareholding, in many cases, we can be the largest shareholder or a top five shareholder. And that typically gets us a seat at the table. And there it's very much about engaging constructively, proactively, and typically privately, but occasionally publicly. In the investment trust sector, where we have a long history of being an engaged activist shareholder, most of the situations we're invested in, you can assume that we are engaging very proactively behind the scenes with managers and boards, making suggestions and having discussions. On occasion, that will tip over into the public domain, but it's never our starting point for it to do so.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, let's perhaps go into the investment trust side of the portfolio for now. One name that, you know, as you characterize it, things have spilled over with is Hipgnosis, which AVI has been involved previously in discussions about whether or not to vote for continuation last year. What's your take now? You know, we've seen kind of NAV write-downs on the trust. We're seeing a lot of changes, and now people are kind of wondering, you know, how are they going to get out or what's going to be the ultimate fate of that fund?
Well, I'm limited in what I can say. Clearly, you refer to the write-down in NAV.
Mm.
That is somewhat disappointing. We are still shareholders in the company, and we continue to see upside from here. The path may be a little bit messy and torturous at times, but ultimately we see reasonable value in the underlying assets.
Mm. I mean, more generally, I suppose, what's your kind of take on the state of affairs in the trust space? Because I suppose there's perhaps an interesting conflict where valuations look really interesting, discounts are still in many cases wide, but we're also seeing all of this kind of messy consolidation and so on. So is that a complexity that the team is looking to embrace, or is it kind of not really worth the hassle?
Oh, very much so. It's one of the most exciting times to be investing in the investment trust space that I've seen in my career. I've been at AVI for 22 years. And you see that reflected in the allocation within AVI Global Trust to the investment trust space, which stands above 30% currently and has been increasing over the last 18 months. It's fair to say that our other areas of the stock market are also attractive. So there's a lot of competition within AVI for capital. But the investment trust space, I suppose what's happened is discounts have opened up. Investors have gone away from the sector in many cases. Investors got scarred, particularly by the sell-off in growth. They got disillusioned with many trusts. Discounts started to widen. And part of what you've seen is a lack of buyers and a dominance of sellers, and that's led to widening discounts. And oftentimes, we see that being exaggerated and not reflective of underlying fundamentals. So we see attractive discounts to attractive, good quality underlying assets.
Does it become harder, I suppose, to see that recovery in the trust space? Because you do have those structural trends now going quite hard against you. For example, wealth managers are consolidating. That means they find it hard to hold trusts, below a certain size threshold and so on.
Yeah, that is a challenge. But what I found about the sector over the past 20-odd years is that it does tend to reinvent itself and does tend to find a place for it in portfolios. There are periods of time when there's less demand than supply, and I guess we're going through that now. But ultimately, I think the attractions or the attractiveness of the investment trust universe, what it offers private investors, wealth managers as well, is a fantastic opportunity. And these discounts won't stick around forever. And you're already seeing other kinds of investors step into the fold and take up perhaps some of that slack that you're seeing from the exiting, consolidating wealth managers.
Who do you see taking up the slack?
Well, obviously the most recent news is Elliott taking a large stake in Scottish Mortgage. I think that's interesting. You've had the likes of Saba Capital increase their exposure to the investment trust space quite actively over the last 12 to 18 months. And they have a large number of holdings within the space. And they're clearly drawn to the fact that discounts are wide. And over time, you see a mean reversion of those discounts.
Mm. Is that generally kind of an encouraging sign for you as an investor, the prospect of sitting alongside those more public activists and so on? I mean, it's Scottish Mortgage's discount already seems to have come in recent days, I noticed. And
yeah, it's come in. I suppose it was as wide as 20% or more than 20% some months ago, and it's now back in single digits. Yeah, it's great to have other investors alongside us, either directly in the same names or in other names, scouring the universe. Because ultimately, what is going to lead to a narrowing of discounts is capital. And whether that capital comes from more specialist investors, whether it comes from more traditional investors or retail investors, ultimately, it has the same effect. And that is to rebalance the supply and demand and lead to a narrowing of discounts.
Mm, mm. I suppose then in some cases, these things can be quite drawn out. I mean, you think of, say, you mentioned Elliott, people in the investment trust space mainly know Elliott for 10 years ago now, but that very bruising spat with Alliance Trust that ultimately was successful, but was quite a nasty affair at the time.
Yeah, look, things do take a long time. And the investment trust space, like any sector, has its particular nuances and ways of doing things. For us, we always like to position ourselves in trust where we don't need something to happen overnight or in the short term. We can generate returns from the NAV growth. So provided we're buying something, albeit on a wide discount, that is likely to be appreciating in value, even though the discount can stay wide for an extended period of time, we can still generate good returns for our investors. It becomes a different story when you find yourself invested in, say, a pound of assets trading at 80 pence, for example, but the clock is ticking because that pound of value is shrinking in value year in, year out. And it becomes a race against time to capture that discount before it evaporates. But if you're in something that's a pound today, a pound 20 tomorrow, a pound 50 the day after, then even though your shares are still standing on a wide discount, you can still generate a return from that growth. And that's really what we're trying to do within AGT.
Do you think it's kind of the current conditions have maybe shown how resilient certain sectors are? I mean, I was thinking recently about kind of dividend cuts in the trust space and that kind of thing. And I suppose one area is the energy storage space. And people have made the case that perhaps that's just not really a mature enough sector to kind of hold up in these kind of conditions.
Well, I think one of the challenges for the sector is that over the past 7-8 years, where we've had extremely low interest rates, any trust or any asset class that was able to demonstrate income generating capacity and dividend paying capacity was able to raise a lot of capital and draw in a lot of investors. And in many ways, some of that investment was naive in that it expected those asset classes to be uncorrelated to other risk assets and to be immune from the effects of rising interest rates, or they assumed that interest rates would remain low forever. And this has been a rude awakening for them. And so what you found is that investors see themselves invested in what they thought was an income fund, but then they realize that it's not generating an attractive income anymore.
Mm.
Coupled with the effect of asset value write-downs as interest rates and hence discount rates have gone up. So you've got a situation in which, again, it's about more sellers than buyers.
Mm. I guess kind of turning to rate rises, it really caught my eye perhaps a year ago that AVI Global sort of really piled into the private equity space via trusts, and you also hold some companies too. I suppose kind of focusing on, you know, those enormously wide discounts and so on. How is your, I suppose, what's your stance on that now? Has your allocation kind of shifted around? And how do you deal with the concerns about PE returns going forward in a higher rate environment?
So this is often the case for us. We tend to see opportunities or potential opportunities quite early. And as we're building our conviction and confidence around that, we tend to take a more basket or scattergun approach. So following the volatility, the sell-off that we saw in the growth area of the market in 2022 predominantly, early in 2023, we looked around the trust space and the listed private equity space in particular and saw a lot of discounts, a lot of very wide discounts, and started building a basket allocation to about 10 names, 10 different names, relatively small holdings for us. But over time, as our conviction built, and expanded around some of those names, the basket evolved. Some names were exited. We took some profits and focused our attention and our capital on a limited number of holdings. So you see in our portfolio, we've got Oakley Capital as a large stake, but that predates the 2023. That's been a long-standing investment for us. But Princess and Pantheon were part of that basket, and they matured and evolved into relatively large holdings for us. And what drew us to there were not only the wide discounts, but the fact that we believed that the NAVs were more realistic than many investors feared them to be. There was a lot of fear within the investor space at the time that we were going to see a repeat of 2008 and 2009, when the space saw savage write-downs and trusts were in a difficult financial position given their commitments and the lack of realizations and oftentimes gearing. So today, when we looked at the space, we saw in some cases more mature underlying portfolios, relatively reasonably valued, not excessively valued, generating a lot of free cash flow. We saw balance sheet strength, not only at the portfolio level, but at the trust level as well. And, you know, what you've seen over that time, recently with Princess, earlier with Pantheon, is a very appropriate attitude emerging towards capital allocation and recognition by boards that if their shares are on materially wide discounts, 30, 40%, then in all likelihood, the best investment they could make would be to buy back their own shares at those kind of discounts rather than make new investments at a pound of value as opposed to 60 pence, say.
Is that being responsibly managed? I guess, I mean, I found that really interesting. Yeah, you saw Pantheon announcing lots of buybacks last year, and last year you saw Harbourvest then doing a kind of setting a pool up for a kind of ad hoc special dividends buybacks program. And now you've seen Princess talking about kind of using free cash flow for buybacks and so on. Is there a point where that will become a note of caution, or you'd worry about it sort of diluting returns and that kind of thing? Or does it all seem under control still?
To us, it seems absolutely the right thing to do, and to recognize that it's no good for shareholders if your trust is trading at substantial discounts, and it's the responsibility of the board to balance those demands of shareholders to have exposure to private equity, but also to manage their capital allocation efficiently, and to recognize that at times the better returns are probably from their own shares and buying more of their portfolio effectively rather than making new investments. So, yeah, absolutely, we're very supportive of all of that.
And how do you feel about the sort of outlook in an era of kind of higher rates, even if from a very low bar?
So I think that private equity covers a broad church of opportunities. But what it comes down to me is fundamentals. So it depends upon the quality of the assets, the quality of the businesses, and the price you pay for them. And what we're seeing in a number of cases is good quality private equity businesses. And we see this across our portfolio, whether it's in investment trusts, or whether it's in holding companies that own private assets, that where they own really good businesses that generate free cash flow, that are conservatively managed, that have strong balance sheets, and not trading at the kind of excessive multiples that you might see in parts of the stock market, then very much so, we expect them to generate attractive long-term returns and are not that worried about the effect of rising interest rates. Mm. It's only where valuations are excessive, the starting point is too high, and where you've got debt as well and lack of cash flow generation, that you really have to worry about it.
Mm. So what are the kind of key metrics you would look at generally, like cash flow generation?
Cash flow generation, gearing to EBITDA or some kind of cash flow multiple, general debt or cash on the balance sheet, and also an assessment really of the quality of the business.
Okay, so let's turn away from trusts, sadly, and perhaps turn to Japan, obviously a big part of the trust. And you guys run a separate trust as well, focused on simply on Japan. I guess, first of all, I was interested in the Japanese market has finally kind of had the huge recovery that was a big part of last year. How does that kind of affect the investment case and how you go about approaching that market?
Well, you're absolutely right. Japan had a great year and has had a great start to 2024 as well. Unfortunately, for many UK-based investors and investors based outside Japan, those returns have been diluted and muted by the effects of a weakening yen. But very much so, you can see by looking at what's gone on in the Japanese indices that Japan has had a fantastic run. I think this is just the beginning. So from our standing point, when we look at our universe, which is primarily focused on small mid-cap companies, we still see hugely attractive valuations. We still see loads of companies with far too much cash sitting idly on their balance sheet, depressing valuations. And we also see good businesses. We see businesses that are growing their sales, that are growing their profits, that are increasing their margin, and that have been run relatively inefficiently for many years, and that offer very attractive opportunities, both in terms of valuation re-rating, but also in terms of operational and strategic initiatives that could be employed in order to improve their profitability and generate more value. And the icing on the cake, really, for the opportunity is that for the first time in 30 plus years, management at Japanese companies actually care about the share price. They want to know what they can do in order to generate returns for shareholders. And that has been the big success of the third arrow of Abenomics, that focused on structural reforms and initiated or introduced the corporate governance code and the stewardship code. And I think 2023 was really a transformational year in Japan, in that investors understood that Japanese companies have finally got it. And that's really what has sustained the interest of foreign investors into Japan over the course of the last 12, 15 months.
Are you finding there are more kind of, I suppose, rival buyers and investors to contend with now? Because I think even the investment trust space, you've had a few names come up that, again, make it their kind of their thing to take that approach.
Yeah, I think that's a positive, actually. I wouldn't necessarily refer to them as rivals, more like peers. Yes, we're all trying to do the same. We're trying to attract investors, trying to generate the highest returns. But ultimately, the more the merrier. Japan was notorious for when you went to see a company in Japan and you complained to management, they turn around to you and say, you know, you're the only disappointed investor. All my other shareholders love what we're doing. I don't hear any other complaints. But what's happened over the last few years with this increase in engagement and shareholder activism is that there's more discussion amongst activist type of investors. There's more public campaigns. And that has really allowed and fueled an interest from a diverse range of investors, from the more traditional, boring institutional investors to the very aggressive hedge fund activists. And they're all putting pressure on companies. And that's really what's led to this shift in psychology in Japan, whereby now management recognize that their job is not only to keep everybody employed and pay everybody a pension, it's also to generate a return for shareholders.
And are there any kind of, I suppose, sectors or themes that you find yourself gravitating to in Japan as part of the way the trust operates?
So the big theme for us really is excess cash on the balance sheet. So we're drawn to companies that have got at least 30% of their market cap in net cash. And at times we find ourselves invested in companies that have 70, 80 plus percent of their market cap in net cash or other securities or real estate. So those kind of situations are found across the sectors in Japan. There isn't a particular type of sector that has accumulated a lot of cash. It's really part of the Japanese psychology. And for us, that's where we see the greatest valuation dislocation and the greatest opportunity for engaging with management and encouraging them to improve capital allocation, improve returns on equity, and drive higher share prices.
And I suppose kind of looking beyond Japan, I mean, are there any parts of the world that you tend to find yourself gravitating towards? I mean, I suppose some markets are viewed as less loved and more undervalued than others. UK probably still perennially one of those.
Yeah. You know, historically, we've been very active within Europe, where we've invested a lot into family-controlled holding companies. They happen to be listed in Europe, but generally have business exposure around the world. In the last couple of years, we've found ourselves finding more opportunities amongst North American holding companies, US holding companies, which is an area historically we've had very little exposure to. We have some exposure to emerging markets. We have a large investment in a company in Mexico. We've had some investments in India. So there isn't really anywhere we haven't been. I would say that China is a market that we've avoided. And like many other investors, we felt that if you think about what it is we're trying to do in that we're buying companies trading at discounts to net asset value, if you believe that markets are efficient, then the discount is justified. And what we're trying to do is find situations where we think the market is wrong and the discounts are not justified. In China, when you think about it, those discounts are quite rational because you don't know really what's going to happen to your business. You don't know whether your profits are going to be confiscated or taxed, or your assets are going to be confiscated. Mm. And in that kind of situation, you very much want to be buying a pound of assets for as little as possible. So a discount is warranted. So those are the kind of situations we avoid.
And how do you feel more generally about, I suppose, kind of emerging markets? Are there, for example, any other markets where you perhaps tread a bit warily due to, things like kind of unexpected regulation and so on? And equally, you know, do you to any extent find yourself or see yourself kind of gravitating towards any of those markets more over time, just perhaps because there are more opportunities and so on?
Well, some of our largest positions are 8-9% of our NAVs, are pretty concentrated. And I would say that if we are invested in an emerging market, an investment would rarely start at that kind of size. So yes, it would be a case of growing confidence and conviction around the story based on the catalysts that we see playing out and the conviction that they're going to play out. So probably we are more wary when we find ourselves invested in emerging markets. Mm. But the point about AVI Global is that, yes, we're a global trust, but we don't have to be invested everywhere. Mm. We're about finding that limited number, maybe 15, 20, 25 names that we have the greatest confidence in. And if we have zero weighting to emerging markets, that's absolutely fine. If we're overweight Japan, that's absolutely fine, because it's built around this fundamental thesis that things are happening and there's attractive value there. Mm. And if we can't build up that confidence in particular markets, whether they're developed, whether they're emerging, whether they're big constituents of the index or not, that's fine with us. We'll generate our returns elsewhere.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting. I suppose some funds, when they're kind of targeting future trends and so on, they're almost potentially forced into certain markets to an extent, and then you have to,
right,
all sorts of things you have to navigate. But I suppose kind of flipping the subject on its head, I'm always interested in why people exit positions. For example, you recently sold out of Pershing Square, one of the very successful investment trusts, huge returns over a long time, rare name to actually beat the US market quite consistently. What kind of prompts you to actually get out of a position?
Yeah. Well, there are a couple of factors that we think about when it comes to exiting a position. And in many ways, we felt that exiting Pershing was leaving the party early, in the sense that whilst it had done extremely well in terms of NAV performance and in terms of share price performance, we were leaving at a time when it was still trading on a relatively wide discount in the high 20s, I think, when we sold it. And it's obviously narrowed since that time as well. And there's absolutely nothing fundamentally that we disliked about it. In fact, we liked all the underlying assets. Hmm. So if you turn the question around to me, in that case, why did we sell? And the reason we sold really was that we felt there were better opportunities elsewhere, but more specifically, we felt there were better opportunities, there were better ways of getting exposure to some of the assets within Pershing Square that we actually liked. And when you look at Pershing Square's portfolio, the largest asset in there is Universal Music, which is something we have a high degree of confidence in and we like a lot. And we've been building a position in a European family holding company called Bolloré. And Bolloré has a direct stake in Universal Music Group. He's the largest shareholder in Vivendi, which is going through its own restructuring plans over the next few months, splitting itself up into three or four different companies. And the discount on Bolloré is much wider than the discount on Pershing Square, closer to 50% than the close to 30% that we saw in Pershing. And moreover, we think that the timeline on in the Bolloré case is likely to see things happening over the next 6 to 12 months. So it wasn't really a case of giving up on Pershing or something fundamentally wrong. It was just more about, with limited capital, where can we position ourselves to have the greatest expected return within the shortest space of time.
And do your kind of catalysts for returns, they must change over time? I suppose there must, for example, we've talked a lot about activism, but there must be more of that in difficult times like we've seen in the last 12 or 18 months and so on.
Yeah, we're seeing a huge amount of catalysts across our universe. So yes, there's the activism of ourselves and others that you see in the investment trust space and you see in Japan. But within the holding company space, such as Bolloré, such as FEMSA in Mexico or Schibsted in Norway, what we're seeing is management, whether it's the shareholders or the professional managers, looking at their company, looking at the share price, looking at the very wide discount, oftentimes north of 40%, and thinking, well, this doesn't make any sense. What can we do about it? And what we're finding is many companies are initiating strategic reviews. They're thinking about the structure, they're thinking about the perception in the market, the valuation of their businesses, and what they can do about it in order to address that discount.
So lots to keep an eye on. Very interesting stuff, but I'm afraid we are out of time. So I'd simply like to thank Joe for coming on. Thanks to our very talented producer, Maddie Apthorpe. And thank you to yourself for listening. Take care.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.